Welcome to part two of our special conference edition of the Dive and Dig podcast, brought to you by the Honor Frost Foundation, a charity that supports maritime archaeology in the Eastern Mediterranean. This time, interviews with researchers at the International Congress for Underwater Archaeology in Helsinki, Finland, focus not on shipwrecks, but on people in their maritime cultural landscapes, exploring submerged settlements and boats in bogs. Let's go back to Kathy and Lauren to find out more.
So as well as lots of really fascinating papers here, we've also got a huge number of posters here talking about different projects from around the world. And we're looking at one now called Historical Harbours and Toponyms, Understanding the Dynamic Maritime Cultural Landscape of the Indus Delta in Pakistan. So if you guys could just introduce yourselves for us.
Hi, I'm Hiba Hashmi.
And I'm Amir Khan.
And we're representing the Maritime Archaeology and Heritage Institute, or MAHI for short, and we are based in Karachi and Pakistan, and we study the Western Indian Ocean, maritime archaeology in the Western Indian Ocean.
Excellent. And am I right in thinking that this is one of the first maritime archaeological projects that has been undertaken in your region?
Yes, it has, especially under the official banner of maritime archaeology. There's obviously been coastal archaeology, and there have been excavations done around in and around the delta and along the coast, but it hasn't officially looked at it from a maritime archaeological perspective.
So could you give us a brief summary of your project?
So the IMAP project, as it's called, is the Inventory of Maritime Archaeology in Pakistan, and this is an attempt to develop a baseline data set of the maritime archaeological sites along the coastline and within the Indus River Delta in the two major coastal provinces of Sindh and Balochistan.
The Indus Delta in particular is an interesting case study because we have a very sort of high wave climate, and there's a lot of geomorphological change happening in the delta, which means it keeps changing, which means settlements throughout history have come up and have fallen quite constantly. And what we have now from the legacy data are a series of ports on the Indus Delta, which have different names, starting with Maluha from the Indus civilization, and then through to Patala during Alexander's campaigns in Sindh, Debul during the early Islamic period, Lahori Bandar in the Mughal period and during indigenous rule within Sindh, and then finally the old Sindh during the European colonial period with the arrival of the Portuguese and then the Dutch and the British. And now it's known as Karachi, which everyone knows, which came up during the British period.
Oh, wow. So yeah. So where do you start, I mean, with all of this? How are you recording and surveying these sites?
Well, we're using a range of methods at the moment. I mean, there's a large amount of legacy data, so we're starting with that, and that's a combination of looking at archaeological reports, looking at historical narratives of the region, travel logs, etc. We're also looking at historical maps and of course, aerial imagery of those areas and satellite imagery, and trying to identify sites associated with some of these historical accounts. Beyond that, it's a combination of techniques with ground truthing particular sites, and so that'll include sort of diver-based assessments, and then identifying areas of high archaeological potential, so doing geophysical surveys as well. Further to that, we're probably, and this is again the first time we've been within the project, looking at interviewing local communities and trying to understand where some of the archaeological sites or the submerged shipwreck sites might be based on their local knowledge, but then also engaging with traditional practices, and that includes boat building, mm-hmm. and various maritime trades. Mm. So the objective is somewhat of a multi-pronged approach, but there's a lot to do.
Yeah.
And really we just got to get started with sort of getting the basics. Now we've actually done a full year of desktop work, and we're hoping to proceed into the actual field work this year.
Wow, that's a lot. And will the local community, where you're engaging them to find sites, will you be engaging them to help with any of the recording as well? Is that part of the plan, or to keep an eye? I don't know if how affected the area is, for example, if there's like a storm event and archaeology might be exposed. Will you engage a sort of citizen science approach with that?
Absolutely, yeah. The good thing is we've just become international training partners for the Nautical Archaeology Society.
Great.
So that gives us access to materials that we can use to train the local community. We're obviously developing formal and informal relationships with them throughout the project, so while we're collecting interviews and we're asking them questions about the intangible heritage of the region, we're also asking them about shipwreck locations, we're also educating them about what we're doing, mm-hmm. and it's really sort of it's grabbed their attention,
yeah.
and their interest, and it's fostered an interest in their own heritage,
yeah.
which is the ideal situation.
That's
as,
a really
as
good
you know.
Two-way
yeah.
relationship
yeah.
there yeah,
yeah.
that's
yeah.
excellent. Is there anything else you want to add? It's fascinating. I'm sure there's lots we could talk about.
I just want to say that we're very lucky to be supported by the Arcadia Fund and just to be part of a larger family of projects which are documenting endangered archaeology across the world. And we hope to sort of continue finding cool stuff
yeah.
in the Indus
yeah.
Delta.
Yeah,
ideal job, yeah.
I just finally, I just add, it's just been such a pleasure being here at ICWA and meeting folks from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
And just sort of sharing stories about, you know, how they've progressed through their journeys and as we get started on ours.
Yeah, that's amazing.
It's very inspiring.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was great to meet you. Thank you very much.
Likewise.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're moving away from shipwrecks and we're going to talk a bit now about a Neolithic lake settlement that has been found. And firstly, the amazing preservation and the material that we're finding on these sites, but also the challenges that come with that as well. So could you just introduce yourself for us?
Yes, of course. My name is Satu Koivisto and I come from the University of Turku in southwest Finland. And I am a wetland archaeologist or a field-oriented archaeologist with a special interest in wetland areas.
Okay. And the particular Neolithic settlement that you spoke about, I'm not sure I can pronounce the name, I wrote it down, but what was the name of the site?
It is Järvensuo 1, which means it is like translated Lakes Bog
okay.
1 site.
Excellent.
Yes.
And there was some recent excavations on that site in the last few years. So could you just tell us about what you found and the interpretation of the site so far?
Yeah, the work is still ongoing, but we had two very good fieldwork seasons in 2020 and 21. The excavations were very small in scale because in wetland environment you cannot open too large trenches, or you must have very good research questions in mind if you want to do something like that. It was very deeply buried archaeology. Archaeological horizons, they are located deeply down inside peat and Lake Kytsja in a depth of almost 2 meters. But the preservation conditions in those depths are still quite good. The groundwater level fluctuates nowadays quite much because of the drainage of that area. It is an agricultural field, a peatland farmland today, so there is a lot of fluctuation in the groundwater level, and that of course affects to the preservation state of these organic archaeological remains. But based on our 2 fieldwork seasons, we found quite a lot of organic material still. The site was initially found in the 1980s in a ditching work, and then it was excavated in a very small scale, very small trenches were dug there. And now in my current project, I was interested in about the preservation state of the site, and that's why we did some re-excavations there. We've found quite a lot of Neolithic fishing-related artifacts associated with net fishing, especially, and fishing with wooden stationary structures, different types of fish traps and weirs as well. Mm-hmm. We have some net floats made of pine bark and some sinker stones wrapped in birch bark with some cordage in them as well. And then we have these very strange figurines as well, animal figurines. There is this one wooden scoop with a bear head carved on its handle, and then we found this snake depiction or a wooden snake figurine, which was a bit strange artifact to find because all the other materials were really fishing related.
Yeah, that's very unusual. What do you think the snake might have been? Have you got any idea?
Actually, we published an article about that finding in Antiquity already a year ago, and we tried to interpret it in the light of Northern Fennoscandian Neolithic rock art, rock paintings, red ochre paintings. And in those paintings you can sometimes find human-like figures, and they are depicted with kind of zigzag lines that have been interpreted as snakes, and some of those human-like figures, they have been interpreted that they have been shamans, and they seem to be holding a snake-like object in their hand, either a real snake or some kind of a snake staff. So that is like one possibility for this kind of finding, but of course it could have been a toy or just a snake figurine for some strange reason. Amazing. So there are a lot of possibilities to interpret.
Oh, that's amazing. So, I mean, you know, this site has been preserved since the Neolithic period, but now we're facing challenges, aren't we? Because I don't know if it's changing climate or, but the site is ultimately at risk of drying out and lose, you know, we're going to lose this material. So could you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. After the last excavations or the previous excavations in the 1980s, I have interviewed some of the archaeologists that took part on that fieldwork, and they needed their pumping systems already from the topmost layers. We didn't use any pumping systems at all, even though we reached the bottommost layers in the depth of nearly 2 meters. So that means that the water level has really lowered in only 35 years, which is quite alarming. But that is mostly because of the drainage system, because it is still a cultivated area. But also climatic changes. Now this extreme weather incidents. We have very, very dry and very, very warm summers, even here in the north. And some summers they are extremely wet and cold. So these extreme conditions, they are not doing good for archaeology as well.
That's, you know, that's really sad, isn't it? But I mean, what's the solution? That's tricky, isn't it? Because we can't record everything. I guess we can monitor and do what we can and publish what we can, but you know, ultimately the material is going to be lost, I suppose.
Yes, it will eventually be lost, absolutely, and we must do our best to collect as much data as we can. And also we need more wetland-oriented archaeologists as well, even in Finland. Even though that we have a lot of wetlands, especially peatlands, there are not many archaeologists who are really focusing on wetlands, probably because they are so laborious to study and so difficult conditions there, and wet and muddy and everything, and also quite costly, of course. If you find organic materials, you have to conserve them and so on, and protect the sites. So we need more archaeologists. We need the whole army of archaeologists to focus on wetlands and try to do our best to collect as much data as possible. And also to monitor the known sites, so that have some kind of risk assessment of the urgency of our actions at certain sites.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, well, good luck with your project, and I really enjoyed your talk, so thank you very much. And thank you for your time.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Okay, here we are. We're now moving to a different part of the world. We're now in the Arctic, and we're in Norway. And please introduce yourself.
My name is Stephen Wickler, and I work as a maritime archaeologist in the Arctic University Museum of Norway in Tromsø, which is at 69 degrees north. So.
Okay. I was fascinated by your boats in bogs. Can you tell me more?
It does have a ring to it, B&B, yeah. A B&B project. No, it's an interesting aspect of northern Norway is the extensive bogs we have. It's very common along the coast, and these bogs were a valuable resource as fuel up until after World War II, where electricity came in. In rural areas, people needed to cut peat to dry and use as fuel. And so as a result of that activity over many, many years, people found things in the bogs. I know people have heard of the Irish butter churns and, butter in buckets found in bogs. So this is similar, but my focus was specifically on parts of boats or things to do with boats that were found in bogs in these peat deposits. And our museum has quite a substantial collection of this material that people gave to the museum over a period. Our museum is quite old. It was founded in the late 1800s. And so we have finds going back to the 1880s of these boat pieces. And ironically, no one ever looked at them. These were sent in by people, and none of the archaeologists at the museum bothered to go and check where the find sites were or talk to the people afterwards. And so they were just laying at the museum unused for years and years. And I started this small project where I went through all of the material and dated it with radiocarbon, all of the material I could find that looked to be substantially older. And not just boat parts, but things related to that.
Like what other things? Like oars?
Actually, you had a yoke from mm-hmm. an oxen.
Oh, wow.
Balers, things to bale water from a boat. A number of other sort of peripheral finds that... the thing is, there's a lot of spades that you find in the bogs. And you also find paddles. And they look remarkably similar. But... when you look at them closely, you can differentiate a spade for cutting turf
right.
from a paddle. And so I dated some of these spades as well, just out of interest, and in addition to the boat finds. But it a remarkably broad range of items related to boats, paddles, oars, actual boat pieces, and then we have a number of boats that were intentionally buried in the bogs in ritual contexts. And this is especially from the Roman period, where you get the same thing in Denmark with bog bodies and
right.
things like that. And boats were used the same way. We have a log boat that was deposited, and it was halfway down in the bog, and it was at 50 meters above sea level. So there's no way it had ever been to the ocean. They cut the tree down, made the log boat, and then intentionally deposited it in a bog. So it's very striking kinds of context that, and they're all remarkably well preserved. They look like they were made yesterday.
Wow.
And I think that's the reason that we probably just have the tip of the iceberg in terms of the number of finds that never made it to the museum. Because people saw things, oh, that's probably from 20 years ago.
Ah.
And they never bothered to send it to me. They didn't think it was old enough.
Preservation was so good.
Yeah, and I think it surprised people themselves that it could be that old. I think no one had an inkling. Even at the museum, the labels on the pieces of boats said, oh, probably from the late 1800s.
Right.
Typical right. boat frame.
Yeah.
And then I find out that it's from 500 BC.
Right.
Right? And if the archaeologists couldn't distinguish it, well, think of the people
yes.
like taking up the bog, peat. So I can just imagine how much we've lost
yeah.
over time.
Now, you talk about oars. I thought that was interesting because you said it was a revolutionary development for seagoing. Can you speak more about that?
Absolutely. The transition from paddling to rowing, I think that was bigger than the introduction of the sail, which probably happened sort of in the late Iron Age, you know, in the 8th century. Because you can think a canoe, it's very narrow, they may be quite long, but paddling, it's limited how fast you can go. And also the size of the vessel was limited. When you started using like naturally grown frames, you could, in a vessel that was rowed, you suddenly increase the size potential of the boat, you increase the speed dramatically, like 3, 4, 5 times as fast. And because you can have bigger boats, it also increased the capabilities of going offshore and really using the boat in a marine context. You didn't have to hug the coast like you did in a paddled canoe.
Right, so. Okay. And the other thing I found interesting were your marine mounds. Can you say more about that?
Yes, in Arctic Norway, it's a quite a common site type, and most of them are called farm mounds. Traditionally, they've been called farm mounds, but I've intentionally changed the terminology for these mounds that are on these smaller islands, extremely offshore, where we know nobody was doing any farming. I mean, you can't call something a farm mound if it had nothing to do with the
farming,
farm.
Yeah.
People were only fishing, you know. And so I've opted for this terminology, and I've called them marine settlement mounds as opposed to a farm mound, because I think that's far too limited, and it doesn't really express what I'm dealing with in these sort of fishing locations. You build up the mound in the same way as the traditional farm mounds, but it's based on a totally different type of resource exploitation. You don't have the sort of animal husbandry or anything to do with crops, or but it builds up in the same way. But what you have in the mound is very different, because you have this extreme marine resource focus in the mound. So you find very different things in these maritime mounds.
Cod was one of the...
Cod was central.
Central.
But you think... cod was only in the winter, the migratory cod, which became stockfish, which they dried and exported. But you also had summer fishing with different types of fish, and you also had the coastal cod, which is much smaller, and that you could get year-round. So you had very different types of fish depending on the season and the location, and the cod only came in the period from like March to late April, when they were spawning. So you got these big cod that were the source of stockfish, but they were only a very narrow part of the year. So they relied on many other fish species throughout the rest of the year.
And these mounds were actually living clusters, were they?
Yeah, they were. People were living on the mound, and you can see the foundations of multiple houses built one upon the other, on top of one another, and that's what caused the great accumulation. Some are up to 3 meters thick. And it's this combination of foundation remains, and then the turf is an essential component, and that came from the walls of the houses. Almost most of the houses were built of turf, because for one thing, there was very few sources. There were no forests, no trees, nothing. So getting a hold of wood was a difficulty, especially on these like offshore islands. So turf was the one
was
material.
King. Yeah.
Yeah, and the importance of turf there is also insulating. You know, it was cold. So,
very
I mean,
cold.
You want turf has an excellent ability to insulate the house. It may have been awfully smoky in there, but it was insulated. So,
right.
And you know, turf from one structure to another, it's an extremely dense material. So automatically you build up huge deposits just with the turf itself. And then wall collapse and the house roof collapse. And so just structural remains. I mean, you could call them like the tells in the Near East, but it's nothing like that, the complexity.
Right.
But it's this It's the same process of sedimentation.
And
quite rapid, quite rapid. Although a lot of them were in use maybe 500-600 years. And many, many of the mounds are still occupied today in northern Norway. There's houses on the top of them.
Oh, right.
And it creates a big headache for archaeologists because they're digging into a protected site every time they put in a sewer line or want to dig a basement.
Yeah. And who's there living on those mounds?
The people that have lived there since the medieval period.
Right.
A lot of it's the same families, the same groups that were there since the beginning, the end of the Viking Age.
Even. Right. Fantastic. Yeah. Gosh, Stephen, thank you so much. It was wonderful to be taken to that part of the world.
It's a wonderful part of the world. It's beautiful.
Yeah, so beautiful. Thank you again.
So far, we've been talking to a lot of people about shipwrecks, which is understandable when it's a conference about maritime archaeology and about how to protect and manage shipwrecks. But I'm now talking to Maria, who has highlighted it's not just about shipwrecks, it's also about a wider maritime cultural landscape. So we're going to chat about that a bit now. Would you like to firstly introduce yourself?
I'm Maria Michael. I have just finished my PhD at the University of Southampton, and my research was supported by Honor Frost Foundation, and it's about the study of fishing activity in Cyprus through time, specifically from the Neolithic to Early Christian period.
Amazing. So essentially, you're looking at both tangible and intangible evidence of fishing activities around the coastline. And some of the points that you made today were really interesting about how you record that kind of evidence, how in the past people perhaps haven't taken that as an archaeological resource quite as seriously as other sites perhaps. So how did you start really recording some of these sites?
The idea to start the study of fishing activity was because I read an article of Honor Frost that she highlighted that the study of fishing activity in Cyprus was a neglected subject because no one paid much attention to study them. And especially during the excavation, people, they didn't use any methodological approach in order to collect the fish remains, which is the main indicator of the fishing activity. And also they didn't pay any attention to understand and to interpret the evidence of fishing gear. For example, some of the net weights, the most of time they use them as, they interpret them as loom weights or weights for other activities not related to the fishing activity. So this, which was a challenge at the beginning, because many people, many archaeologists that are working in Cyprus, when I told them, you know, I want to study fishing activity, they told me you will not find anything. So at the beginning it was a challenge, but at the end it was the motivation that gave me the chance to study the fishing activity. So I start reading more the excavation records, the publication of excavations in Cyprus in order to see if they publish the evidence of fishing gear or the fish remains. And also I try to visit the archives of the folklore archives in Cyprus in order to see the interviews of fishermen and learn about the fishing in Cyprus, how is this activity and how the Cypriots engage in Cyprus. And also I tried to visit the storerooms of the Department of Antiquities in order to see if the evidence are available to study them.
That's amazing.
Process.
It's an amazing project, and I just think it really highlights that maritime archaeology is not just about shipwrecks, is it? And there's so much more to it, and you've got this whole
maritime landscape where people were working in and on the water every day, and fishing was so much part of their everyday lives and so much part of their identity as well. And it's something that, doesn't survive the archaeological record that easily anyway.
Yes.
And then to not survive the excavation either, because it gets overlooked, it's such a shame. But I'm really pleased to have heard your presentation. So thank you very much, Maria.
Thank you.
Enjoy the conference.
Thank you.
Well, that was really interesting, and it's always good to be reminded that maritime archaeology is not just about ships and boats, as much as I don't like to admit it. These four interviews really show the breadth of the subject and also reveal something else many maritime archaeological sites have in common, and that is threat. Thus, the third and final episode of this Dive and Dig conference podcast will focus on the theme of protecting our past. So join us to learn more about recent initiatives to protect and promote our underwater heritage. Thanks for listening.